of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Hello, we're Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There's no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kboo.org, all one word. Or message us on Instagram at PacUnderground.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9:01 a.m. Next is Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. This week we hear part one of Rob's interview with Cole Merkel, Cadence Petros, and Nathan Teske about affordable housing and homelessness.
On that same lot, he could afford to sell a home at a much more affordable, now smaller home, mm-hmm. right, without the big backyard that.
It's not one intervention that's going to solve this problem. It's multiple tactics from different ends of the spectrum that will help. But adding supply is always a good thing.
Welcome to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. We feature interviews with leaders in the community focusing on issues important to Washington County.
Today, we have part one of our two-part conversation on affordable housing and homelessness. Welcome to Inside Washington County. I'm Rob Solomon. Thank you for joining us today. Today we're going to look at a very, very important topic, especially in our community. We're going to discuss affordable housing. Today we have three guests with us. We have Cole Merkel, who is the Deputy Director of Outreach and Engagement at Here Together, a Portland-based nonprofit that helps find solutions for the systemic crises of homelessness, including issues of housing affordability and equity. Nathan Teske is also with us. Nathan is the executive director of Bienestar, a Washington County-based nonprofit that provides affordable housing for primarily Latinx residents of Washington County. He has over 15 years of experience improving outcomes for immigrant and low-income communities. Also joining us is Cadence Petros. Cadence is the Development Division Director for the City of Beaverton. Her department oversees the development of affordable housing projects within Beaverton. She has served the City of Beaverton for 7 years, first working as Assistant City Attorney before progressing to her current role in the Development Division. We've talked with mayors, we've talked with Metro councilors, we've talked with lots and lots of people. Everyone agrees, affordable housing is a serious problem, if not a crisis in our community. Folks, thank you for being here. And your first question is, why? What's the problem?
Well, Rob, the economics are fairly simple. Mm-hmm. People don't make enough money to pay rent or buy a home. you could get into a lot of economic arguments about why isn't there more supply of housing, rules that different jurisdictions have that make building low-cost housing more difficult in some cases. Also, why don't people have incomes that are allow them to pay rent or buy a home? And obviously, in parts of our region, like Portland and increasingly in Washington County, we're also seeing people who sometimes have no source of income from work, right? And for someone like that, obviously, it's very hard for them to have housing unless there's some subsidy or some sort of affordable housing in place for them.
Some way to make arrangements. Well, yeah. Thank you, Nathan. Would anybody else care to add?
I think it's important to also consider divestment and the fact that we have lost affordable housing stock, and we haven't until about 2 years ago or 3 years ago with the Portland affordable housing bond made really consistent investments in affordable housing stock throughout our communities. We're fortunate now that between Portland, the bond that passed in 2016, and the Metro bond that passed in 2018, we now have nearly $1 billion for affordable housing development. But I think it's important to remember that that money is only going to go toward the sticks and bricks of construction. What we also need to keep in mind is that affordable housing needs to be affordable to those who are most at risk of losing it or those who are currently homeless. And often those folks don't make enough money to be able to actually stay, even move into those units or stay in those units. And so what we at Here Together believe is that we need to deepen the bench of available service dollars so that we can actually get people inside those affordable units, keep them stabilized there, and help realize the potential for those bond dollars that we've passed.
Thank you, Cole. And that's a perfect segue as we move into solutions to the problem. This July, the Portland metro area earned a pretty significant victory for affordable housing with the passage of House Bill 2001, which mandates that many forms of multifamily housing be allowed in single-family zoning areas, and it's the first of its kind for any state in the country. In Washington County specifically, what new opportunities and benefits are arising from the passage of this legislation?
I'll start. In the city of Beaverton, we were already working on a project called the Housing Options Study, which was looking at different residential zones within the city of Beaverton and determining where it made sense to have allowed additional density. Mm-hmm. And then with the overlay now of House Bill 2001 passing, we're pivoting a little bit to make sure we comply with the new state law. And we'll continue to have conversations with our residents about how to make sure that there's ample opportunity for infill development and also to preserve the integrity of existing neighborhoods.
That's a tough goal, but understandable. And you have mechanisms for citizen input?
Absolutely. So this is a project that's being advanced by our planning division, so not a team that I lead, but community engagement is at the heart of all of the work that our planning team does, and of course the work that we do in the affordable housing development side as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. What about the nonprofit perspective, gentlemen?
Yeah, on the House bill you referenced, mm-hmm. I might give an example that would shed some light on the effect this bill would have. I served on a committee in City of Forest Grove, a housing needs assessment committee, and we had a home developer come to that committee and talk about the difficulty of building affordable homes in the City of Forest Grove. And he ran through some quick economics. He said to buy the lot size at the time, before the House bill, in the City of Forest Grove, that was required by the city for most neighborhoods, it would cost about $200,000 to acquire land. Let's say there was bare land in the city of Forest Grove.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Then you had to pay permits and system development charges. He represented to us that before he had built a single physical piece of a house, he was out $300,000.
Mm-hmm.
So then he has to build a house, and of course he wants to make a profit. So his plea to the city there, again this was about a year ago, was if you allowed developing, let's say, four smaller homes on that same lot, he could afford to sell a home at a much more affordable, now, smaller home, mm-hmm. right, without the big backyard that
right.
people sometimes
life.
Want.
Mm-hmm.
But you can just do the math, right, and figure out the land is going to be the same, similar cost, maybe a little bit higher with more density, but a lot of those fees are not going to go up that much. But the ability to sell four assets instead of one obviously will allow the home developer in that case to sell a home maybe at $250,000, something mm-hmm. like that, which is a lot closer to the range of moderate income folks who might be able to get into a home ownership. And then the more of those that are created, it does have a ripple effect down the housing spectrum, right? Somebody who previously was renting, if they can afford to buy a home, it opens up an apartment for somebody else, mm-hmm. and just increases the stock of housing that, you know, ripples down through the system.
It seems like a sound theory.
Yeah.
And has it been tried elsewhere?
Well, this particular bill, like you said?
No, not the bill. But has anybody ever tried that kind of private-public partnership that proved its effectiveness?
I think there's a lot of research to show that this does work. I mean, I guess in this particular case, there are cities that have allowed more density and promoted more density, so I guess we could look to those to see that. The unique thing here is it's going to be the entire state, like all cities over 10,000, I think.
I believe 10,000 is what I read as well.
So mm-hmm. that would apply to most of the cities in the county here.
And Cadence, would you like to add to that?
Yes, as Nathan mentioned earlier, some of the economic factors that have created the hole that we're in, so to speak, for affordable housing. There's been affordable housing issues for many decades, but they've been exacerbated in the last decade. And part of it has been because of the Great Recession, right?
Yes.
Where housing development just ended.
Well, the whole thing blew
up. Everything blew up. It stopped. But people didn't stop coming, and they didn't stop needing a place to live. And so we have this pent-up demand that needs to be met. And if we have infill options like House Bill 2001, if we have other options like the Metro Affordable Housing Bond that will provide more funding for the development of regulated affordable housing, we start to pick up on the housing supply issue.
Mm-hmm.
Then other folks and other interventions can be brought to bear to help people on the wealth creation side so that more people can afford the rents both at the market level and also at the regulated affordable housing level. It's not one intervention that's going to solve this problem. It's multiple tactics from different ends of the spectrum that will help. But adding supply is always a good thing.
What you and Nathan are saying, Cadence, sounds so logical, so great and foundational for attacking this problem. My question would be, why is Oregon the only state doing this?
I don't think Oregon is the only state doing this. Perhaps we're the only state that has a statewide measure of this nature,
mm-hmm.
but other cities and locations have infill development like Vancouver, BC with their aggressive ADU allowances and Seattle as well, where they're doing the same philosophical principles, but maybe with different interventions.
Fair enough. So the only state, but there's lots of other communities that are also following a similar model.
Correct.
Great. Another way that Oregon has seemed to lead affordable housing innovation is with the passage of its Rent Control Act this year. What problems, especially in the Portland metro area, contributed to this push for placing legislative limits on rent increases? Cole?
Well, I spent, before joining Here Together, nearly a decade in direct service with people experiencing homelessness. For 8 years, up until March of this year, I was the vendor program director at Street Roots, which is a newspaper in Portland that folks experiencing homelessness and severe poverty sell.
Mm-hmm.
We were consistently seeing people who were experiencing no-cause evictions, meaning that they were in a house or an apartment, and for any reason whatsoever, landlord could say, it's time for you to go. North Portland specifically, saw several buildings that were completely no-cause evicted and flipped. That lands somebody in so much instability. Not having a home is one of the most destabilizing forces in somebody's life. SB 608 is a great step, at the very least, in the right direction. There are a couple of things to keep in mind about the rent control bill. So it applies only to units that are 15 years old. So units that are below 15 years old, folks can still receive rent increases at pretty much any rate. The no-cause eviction piece of it only applies after somebody has been in a lease for 12 months. And the rent increase connection is still connected pretty much to inflation. I believe it's no more than 7%. And when you've got somebody who is at the very verge, somebody who is a senior living on Social Security or otherwise on a fixed income, somebody with a disability who can't necessarily work in the traditional job market, a 7% increase is still a lot.
Oh, it could be overwhelming when you're running right on the edge. That makes a great deal of sense.
Absolutely. And so I think that, you know, it was a fantastic bill. It was a huge victory to celebrate. And, you know, I believe that it's a starting place that we need to move from.
Well, and it's interesting because with that background, since it's been implemented, even with the limitations, have you seen any trends, positive or negative, in rent stabilization or rent management?
Well, I track rent rates across the metro region, mm-hmm. and I don't know if it's because of the bill or just because of changes in the market, but in a lot of jurisdictions, it has been flatlining the increases, so they're not going down, but they're not going up, or they're not going up as fast as they had been. I don't know how much of that is attributable to the bill and how much of it is just attributable to changes in the rental market right now. You know, you don't raise the rent more, you don't want to scare off tenants and not have vacancies, right? So right. They're still subject to market forces, obviously. So, you know, of course there'll be an uptick again at some point, and so this bill will be in place to protect whenever that comes.
With what you've seen in your review of things flatlining, I'm just wondering, have you seen any of the increases go up as high as 7%, or have the increases that you've noted been significantly lower than 5%?
Yeah, and I'm talking about averages across whole regions,
yes.
Not specific properties. And this is just a magazine we subscribe to that has, you know.
No, fair enough, we're just looking at.
So I couldn't speak to a specific property. If the bill's in effect, I assume that means no landlord can. And I believe the bill says inflation plus 7%, if I remember this right. And so if you consider, I don't know, what is inflation running, 2% right now?
Something.
So that could mean a landlord could still theoretically, let's say right now, raise rents up to 9%.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty healthy cushion for a landlord to be able to increase rents. I think we were seeing double-digit increases in some areas, and the examples Cole gave in the city of Portland where people were literally, you know, 50 families were suddenly out of a house.
With some of the limitations that we've discussed here, I need to ask, what else outside of rent controls needs to be done to reduce the monthly strain on low-income families?
Well, I can start. I mean, Cadence referenced the importance of increasing supply
mm-hmm.
of housing, right? So. I think certainly we believe that with the Portland bond, the Metro bond, and also some resources that the state is putting into, so it's not just the local effort, there's statewide effort. The housing issue is most acute, I think, in the Portland Metro region, but it exists elsewhere in the state as well. And so the combination of all of those different funding sources should create quite a bit new supply of regulated affordable housing, which means that whoever builds it, that you will be regulated much more strictly than this state law we were just talking about in terms of how you can increase the rents. So if you own a regulated affordable housing, which is what my organization does, you take subsidy, and in exchange for taking that subsidy, whether it's from the state or whoever, you are then agreeing to manage the properties in a certain way, only allow people of certain income levels to live there, check their income, and then only raise their rates based on a pretty fixed amount, and it never gets close to 7%.
Which certainly helps families in the program feel some level of security.
Exactly, right. And Cole mentioned earlier the importance of housing stability,
mm-hmm.
right? So we have many cases of families that have lived for 5-10 years in our housing, haven't seen their, and other organizations do the same thing, but haven't seen their incomes go up. They have their kids going to the same school if they have kids.
Mm-hmm.
They're close to their job, right? So they don't have to suddenly scramble to figure out where to live relative to a job they have or services they're receiving. And we just see wonderful outcomes from those families.
What you're saying is it everything else, housing is what we're talking about, but there's an enhancement of community.
Absolutely.
If that's a side effect, it's a darn positive one. Okay. One argument against the specific rent control legislation that the legislature passed is that it creates an exemption for developments built in the last 15 years, potentially encouraging big dollar investments in future pricier developments. What do any of you believe was the rationale behind creating this exemption, and should the exemption be there at all?
I'll start and then have the others chime in. So, whether it's an affordable housing development or a market rate development, mm-hmm. you are going to have to get financing of some kind for it. And the reason I understand that the 15-year exemption was in place was to enable the developers to obtain financing for those new projects, because they want to make sure, the bank, that the security they're getting out of it, the apartment building, can throw off sufficient net operating income to cover the loan payment plus a cushion. And so by exempting out those first early years when the financing is in place, you don't create a contraction in the market, right? It goes back to the, you want to keep the supply coming, even if it's a spendy apartment building. That means that somebody who earns more has now a choice to move into a nicer apartment, opening up maybe a more moderately priced apartment for a moderately incomeed person who's now moving out of a more affordable apartment. So it's like, they call it filtering, but the concept is even the higher income apartments are a benefit, not at the same level, of course, as a regulated affordable housing home, but still a benefit to the overall supply.
Well, it has, the way you outlined it, it has a domino effect. And great. Gentlemen, would you care to add anything to that? Do you think it's fair to have the 15-year provision in the legislation?
I think Cadence makes a good point. The listeners have to understand that when a project is financed, right, you have banks who are lending, and they want to see a financial analysis that goes 15 or 30 years out. Mm-hmm. Anybody who has a conventional mortgage on their home, whether it's 15 or 30 years, the bank is making a bet that you'll be able to do that for 15 or 30 years, right? Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing when they finance an apartment complex, right? So it's an interesting point. If the goal, I hadn't heard that argument, but if the goal is to not choke the supply, because that certainly would be a criticism of that, of a rent control bill, like, hey, you're just gonna stop developers from building new apartments, and that's exactly the opposite of what we need. By allowing that, it allows banks to at least have the comfort, hey, for 15 years, we're gonna give you a loan, and we know that if you need to, and the market allows it, you can increase the rents in order to pay us back, because at the end, that's what the bank wants, to be paid back with interest, right?
I also, believe that Oregon has the shortest time frame of the amount of time that a unit must be built in order to achieve rent control, if that makes sense, compared to the other states that have done that. 15 years is actually one of the shorter.
To encourage more rapid development?
I believe Nathan and Cadence both made that point pretty well.
Okay, excellent. Candace, the city of Beaverton recently received $31 million of the $652 or so million Metro Council affordable housing bond that passed in 2018. I think that's more than most cities in Washington County. What major projects has the city done or is planning to do with that, with those funds?
Thank you. So the amount that we received is based on our pro rata share of by population. So Hillsborough also had a direct entitlement because both Beaverton and Hillsborough are community development block grant entitlement communities. Mm-hmm. And so we have essentially infrastructure in place that will allow us to directly deploy those dollars. Washington County and the Washington County Housing Authority will be doing so on behalf of the smaller jurisdictions in the remainder of the county. So Washington County's allocation was about $188 million to give you an idea mm-hmm. of how the rest of Washington County will be served by the Metro bond. So $31 million sounds like a lot of money, and of course, to us, it is a lot of money, but when you're talking about subsidy required for a regulated affordable housing project, it really just translates to four projects.
Really? Okay.
And of course, they're bringing debt and other equity and other funds to those projects as well. It's not like the initial stages of the Portland bond, where before the constitutional amendment, all of the dollars from the Portland bond had to be spent to put those projects in place and then had to be either owned or operated or both by the local jurisdiction. Now, with the constitutional amendment that passed at the state level, we are able to essentially leverage funds, so bring in the debt from the banks, bring in equity from tax credits, and other sources of funding from foundations or nonprofit organizations themselves, mm-hmm. In order to layer in different funding options so that we can bring these projects together. So in Beaverton, we have four projects. As part of our implementation, we were required to put together what Metro called a local implementation strategy. So based on a whole lot of community engagement with both residents, advocacy groups, developers, all of the people who would be interested in that development, put together a plan for how Beaverton would spend its money. And so we have four projects. The first is what they call a phase one project. So in advance of figuring out all of the details, and even before we had an intergovernmental agreement signed with Metro, we had a project in the pipeline. That project's going to be developed by Reach Community Development, and it will be near Beaverton High School, and is called the Marianne, named after Beaverton's first teacher. And so that project is has one more hurdle to make. It has to go to Metro for final approval, which we'll do probably in the next couple months. And then we anticipate breaking ground in probably early spring, late winter, depending on how the weather turns. And we're really looking forward to that project breaking ground.
How many units?
54.
And all of them affordable?
Absolutely.
Cool. And the three other projects are also in development?
So the three other projects are in varying levels of concept. So the second project is called the Elmonica Project. It's we're working with Metro, actually, on a piece of property they bought with our transit-oriented development funds, and are looking to work with Metro to jointly develop that property. So we would bring a portion of our Metro bond funds, they would bring the land and maybe some of their regional acquisition funds to the table in order to put all of that together to issue a request for proposals for development teams. And we anticipate that will go out in the next few months. And then a third project we have will be not on publicly owned land, but instead we say it's a notice of funding availability. We have this amount of money that we are making available. We want to get this number of units out at these levels of affordability. And we really are looking for a high opportunity area. Right now, most of the affordable housing, while dispersed, it's really dispersed through the northern area of Beaverton, including downtown, but doesn't really go south of Allen Boulevard. And so we're very much interested in seeing new affordable housing development, particularly in South Cooper Mountain. Right, there's a whole lot of both single family and multifamily development that's about to happen or in like about to be constructed or are already being constructed. And very little, if none of that, will be affordable because of all of the constraints we've talked about earlier, absent intervention by the city. And so we're going to issue that notice of funding availability in the next several weeks and are really looking forward to seeing the proposals that we'll receive from that. And then the fourth project is a little bit delayed because that's a whole lot to happen, but we're thinking that will be probably our most deeply affordable project, predominantly 30% area median income, probably on city-owned property, but we're still working through the details of what that will look like. And we anticipate that we will likely issue a solicitation summer 2020. And all of that happening kind of within this 18-month period is pretty aggressive, but we're trying to get it spent as quickly as possible.
If I can add something just holistically around the Metro Bond, I think one of the brilliant visions of the Metro Affordable Housing Bond was that 40% of the units created need to be at 0 to 30% median family income. That means 40% of the units need to be deeply affordable to those folks that I mentioned earlier, folks who have experienced or are experiencing homelessness, people who are living just paycheck to paycheck or on a Social Security check. It's absolutely essential that we have more units for those people who need homes. I think that's also one of the big challenges of the bond, because with that requirement comes the necessity to have funding to be able to support those folks through rent subsidies, through wraparound case management services. And right now we don't have that funding available. So what Here Together is doing is really trying to respond to that need and that option. We are looking to secure a voter initiative in hopefully 2020 that will focus on creating a new dedicated revenue stream region-wide for homeless and supportive housing services.
Not for the housing itself, but for the services
Correct.
That are so needed
Correct.
For those people. Got it.
We've got the sticks and bricks. We need to have the wraparound dollars to help people transition and stay in.
Thank you very much, Cole. I appreciate it. Cole Merkel from Here Together, and Nathan Teske from Bienestar, Cadence Petros from the City of Beaverton. Folks, thank you all very much. This is an incredibly serious problem. I appreciate the time you've devoted to us. I want to take a moment to thank Shauna Muckle. Our intern came up with some really great research. And folks, if you want to comment, if you want to reach any of these people through our website, that's insidewashco.org. Thank you very much. Next week, tune in for part two.
Thank you for listening to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. Go to our website, insidewashco.org, to contact us or leave comments on this interview. This series is produced by Rick Paulson.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up, at 9:30, it's Culture in Motion, a program about art, culture, politics, education, and social movements with hip-hop as the guiding light, with host Mike Crenshaw.
It's not one intervention that's going to solve this problem. It's multiple tactics from different ends of the spectrum that will help. But adding supply is always a good thing.
Good morning. You are listening to Culture in Motion, the twice monthly show brought to you by your host, Mike Crenshaw. That's me. We talk about the intersections of art, culture, politics, music, activism, and all those good